I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
I mostly write about how humans relate to technology.
I mostly write about how popular culture and movies relate to humans.
This is Still Processing. All right, we're back, and it's a brand new day, Mr. Wesley Morris.
Oh,
you're looking
God,
mighty fine over there.
Thank you very much, NPR voice. I love it.
Hey, I'm professional.
All things reconsidered over here.
So, what's in your pop culture confession booth for the week?
Okay, first of all, I just want to say welcome back.
Welcome back.
It's great to talk to you.
It's what got me out of bed this morning. I'm beyond excited to be back.
I have a question for you.
Shoot.
I've been watching this TV version, the Netflix version of Spike Lee's movie, She's Gotta Have It. 10 episodes, it gets better as it goes, but there are things on this show that are just so mind-blowingly dumb. It's almost like a satire of bouginess.
And so what you're saying is you don't gotta have it.
You should not watch it. And for reasons that we'll talk about later, I think it is worth watching. But at some point, Nola is drunk and locked out of her house and makes a phone call to one of her friends who is in bed doing it, and the friend answers the phone. Have you ever in your life answered the phone while having sex?
No.
Would you ever?
Yes. Absolutely. Here's the thing though, honey. My phone's always on silent, so I don't hear it. But if you were calling, I'd be like, it's an emergency. Who calls people these days? Mm-mm. It means three things. I need bail. I'm in the hospital. Or I'm locked out. Those are emergency situations. You got to pick up the phone. Now, you noticed the friend hung up. She was like, that's not
private. Oh, she hung up.
But
she answered. I just would never answer. I've been noticing that black women are going to therapy on TV, but only on half-hour shows. Insecure,
mm-hmm.
Yvonne Orji's character,
mm-hmm.
seeing a therapist,
mm-hmm.
kind of iffy about it. And Nola's seeing a therapist who's played by Heather Headley on this show.
Mm-hmm.
But you know who needs to be? Black women who need to be in therapy who are not in therapy? Black women on dramas.
Mm-hmm.
Annalise Keating needs to get her ass to therapy. How to get away with murder.
She needs to be on the couch.
She needs to be talking about like how to get away with my mental illness that causes me to kill people.
How to get away with murder and then stop
murdering
people.
And then Olivia Pope should be in therapy. Why? Olivia Pope in all these years of TV has never gone to see a therapist. That's the crime of that show. That's the scandal of scandal. She's no mental health.
I'm picking up what you're putting down. This is right. I'm with you.
And just one last thing.
Okay.
I wish that we could just spend 75 hours talking about all the good subway writing that has been happening in our newspaper. It is important stuff. It didn't end a couple weeks ago with Jonathan Mahler's article in the New York Times Magazine called Case for the Subway. But it definitely culminated in the beauty of the argument for the subway. That piece is really beautiful, and it was written at a high enough level above what it's actually like to ride the subway day to day. I mean, it was such a kind of practical romance of why we need it, and also a history of and a sort of exegesis of all the ways that the subway is America in a lot of ways. And I just thought that was so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cap on all the other great, much more specifically on the ground reporting that the paper's been doing. If you've read none of these subway stories and you live in a city that has a good subway system, you should read this. If you're a New Yorker, you should definitely read this because it'll be like reading a eulogy.
Well, it's a fascinating story about what we define as progress, what happens when progress stops.
Yes, yes. And why we needed to keep going because we've got an apocalyptic situation on our hands in the city if the subway dies. What's going on with you?
So, okay. I very recently went to go see Coco.
Oh, yeah.
With one of my besties, Kimberly. And it's the new Pixar movie, newish Pixar movie, about a little boy named Miguel who wants to be a musician against his family's wishes. And he ends up having to travel to the underworld for Dia de los Muertos, or the Day of the Dead, in Mexico. For anyone who's struggling through these very turbulent political times, it is a beautiful reminder of the richness of Mexican culture and mm-hmm. just Latin American mm-hmm. cultures in mm-hmm. general. And the movie itself, I cried the whole time. I didn't wear glitter eyeliner this time because I just knew not
Thank
to.
God.
But it's just moving. The soundtrack slaps, like try not to Shazam every song yeah. on it. It's so good. It's just really moving. And it's a beautiful movie about family. It tackles death in a really wholesome and just not scary and just very natural way, you know, mm-hmm. and it's very spiritual. Anyway, deeply, deeply, deeply recommend.
It's one of my favorite movies of 2017.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. It was great.
What else?
I'm working on my Reiki attunements. I'm getting all of my chakras aligned.
Mm.
So, you know, more to come this season about my spiritual journey into wellness and well-being. That's all I'm going to say about that for now.
Into? Aren't you?
Farther along.
Okay, I was going to say into just sounded like you just got there.
I'm just going deeper. Season 2 fave, Cardi B, is back. She never went away.
She never.
But she's still
she's
on
not
the
going
scene
anywhere.
With our boy, Bruno Mars, Finesse. A combo. We should play a little bit of that song for a second. You know, I don't know who got their peanut butter and their chocolate, but it is a perfect combination mm-hmm. That we did not know we needed, but it is all I want.
It makes all the sense in the world in a way.
It's fantastic. Okay.
And?
Well, the last thing involves the two of us.
Oh.
Which is that, yes, we went to see Proud Mary, which is the new Taraji P. Henson action film, which is exciting for a lot of reasons, just in that Taraji in an action film. There are no black women in action films. But, you know, I have to say, I thought I was going to be walking into Cleopatra Wick. And instead, I feel like I got Cookie the Lost Years, you know? And look, shout out to Taraji. She got that executive producer credit. I feel like that means a lot. Like, her hands are all over it, and it's good for her, and it's good for her career. But there are a lot of things that are very familiar about the framing of her in that film that mm-hmm. we really have to get into.
I also think that we should talk about the thing that I've been thinking about in the last year, which is that there's just been all this great popular culture involving black women, of which Proud Mary is a part, of which She's Gotta Have It, mm-hmm. and Insecure are a
the
part.
Chai.
Black women making shows, black women starring in shows, directing movies, playing characters that are both familiar and new in some ways, or like the archetype is familiar, but it's never been occupied by mm-hmm. a black woman, and why that's meaningful.
Well, it kind of, you know, there's a long tail, right? There's a long tail that like circles around and kind of causes a little bit of whiplash in the sense that there's a way in which these women are being portrayed in popular culture that then there is this sort of expectation of what kind of work they're supposed to do beyond the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look
mm-hmm.
at that too, because mm-hmm. there's something problematic in the way we're talking about Oprah, the way we talk about the black women voters of Alabama and what their responsibilities are to America. That's all deeply rooted in our, you know, this is right in our sweet spot. It's the intersection of culture, history, class, race, power, privilege. Let's get into it.
Let's do it. We'll be right back.
Okay, we're back, and we're tackling Proud Mary.
Or is Proud Mary tackling us?
If we're in the movie, she's tackling us and gunning us down, because she plays a hit woman mm-hmm. who's part of this black organized crime family in Boston.
Guess what her name is?
Mary. It's weird, because I can't knock this movie, and I don't want to tell people not to go see it, because Wesley, like, when's the last time we saw a black woman in a title role in an action movie on screen? It's unheard of, right? It's like pretty unprecedented.
It's virtually unheard of. There are cases I could present to you, and you can tell me whether you think it's an action movie,
mm-hmm.
like Whoopi Goldberg in Burglar, where she plays a burglar.
Okay.
Not necessarily a hit woman. Halle Berry in Catwoman.
Okay.
These are things that kind of fit in there.
Oh, right, right.
Halle Berry Kidnapped. I mean, it's all Halle Berry. Halle Berry's doing all the action.
I joked a few moments ago that I was expecting a version of John Wick, but I actually kind of was. I mean, you think about how, you know, titular roles go to men for these new action franchises where we're basically repopulating American cinema with different types of James Bond via Fast and the Furious, you know, John Wick, who else? There's a ton of them.
Oh, pick one. Any Bruce Willis
X,
movie.
Any Bruce Willis movie. Right. And I think I went into it thinking like, oh, we're going to get this very cool version of this character that like reinvents Taraji. I was expecting there to be like video game spinoffs, like sequels, but it was really flat.
Yeah.
And it felt like it, I mean, you said this during the movie, and I mean, I knew that going in, but there are points in the movie that are exactly kind of even frame by frame and dialogue that throw back to old school blaxploitation movies.
Yes. Obviously, I'm glad it exists, but I also think that it's not really a terribly remarkable movie as a movie. You really kind of have to be watching it in appreciation of the moment that you're having with this actress being in this type of movie.
Right.
And that's, I mean, for me, that's kind of the most pleasure I got out of this film. So first of all, we should just say that Taraji P. Henson, of course, is best known as the star of Empire.
Cookie Lyons in the house.
And she, I guess, came to prominence for playing Brad Pitt's maid / nanny or mammy in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award.
But people remember her from Hustle and Flow, too, with Terrence Howard.
And everybody remembers her in Hustle and Flow as Shug. Mm-hmm. She should have been nominated for that, by the way, because she was really good. And then she gets this part on Empire, Fox's Empire, about a family that begins in the drug trade of Philadelphia and winds up running a record label. She served the time for her husband, Lucius, and she gets out of prison and she wants some acknowledgement for having suffered on his behalf. She wants some of the record company and she wants her children to acknowledge that she's a good mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a soap opera and she's very good in it. And a lot of what makes her so great is the show just kind of gives itself over to her.
That's right.
And she walks into every scene, tears it down and leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Walks into every scene, tears it down and leaves. They bring the rest of the actors with her in this way that everybody's kind of keyed up. Even the guest stars like Courtney Love and Marissa Tomei. Like,
mm-hmm.
They get really into being able to have a scene with Taraji P. Henson. So now she's taken all this power that she's accumulated. She made Hidden Figures with Octavia Spencer and Janelle Monáe about the women who worked at NASA whose work was underappreciated by American history and perhaps by NASA. And now she's in this. A very different movie from the mathematician she played in Hidden Figures. Not as good a movie as Hidden Figures, needless to say. But I would say important in its own way.
Look, it's 2018. Can't black women do more on screen than just be somebody's mom or just be somebody's sex object?
I was going savior.
The mom is the savior. I was kind of collapsing things,
sure,
you know?
Sure.
But I was going through my library thinking about this movie, and I was looking through Deb Willis's iconic book, Picturing Us, African-American Identities in Photography. And I was really sad to go through the book, you know, because she writes about the first images of black women, African-American women on record, picture them in roles of, you know, obviously roles as servants, but as caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
They're either sexual objects and nude, or they're caring for white children, not black children,
mm-hmm.
right? And I mean, that was the one thing about this film, that if that had been a white child in the film, I would have lost it.
You
so at least, you know, there was this sort of, she was mothering this like lost child from the street. So that was something. But I mean, again, it's like, we can't get away from these archetypes.
So she's right, Professor Willis. And I think what would be useful right now is probably just to step back, maybe stay in 1939 a little bit, and walk ourselves from Gone with the Wind forward quickly.
Yes. Yes.
But we'll illustrate it a little bit. So starting with Gone with the Wind is the place that you typically start
mm-hmm.
when talking about black women in the movies. Mostly because before this, there had been black women doing things in, say, I don't know, the films of Oscar Michaud, a black director, and they had a function there. But mostly in other movies, they had been slaves, domestics, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Gone with the Wind, which came out in 1939, was a, you know, global sensation,
mm-hmm.
or national mm-hmm. sensation. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a global sensation. Starred Hattie McDaniel and Butterfly McQueen.
Great name.
They had the two biggest speaking parts among the slaves.
What a qualifier. God.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on. I mean
you
know?
Have to qualify it because there are a lot of white people in the movie who weren't slaves. Hattie McDaniel won an Oscar for her performance. We'll listen to a little bit of a clip of Gone with the Wind between Hattie McDaniel and Vivian Leigh who also won an Oscar.
I'm going to Atlanta for that $300, and I've got to go looking like a queen.
Who's going to Atlanta with you?
I'm going alone.
That's what you think. I was going to Atlanta with you in that new dress.
Now, Mammy, darling.
No use to try to sweet talk me, Miss Scarlett. I knows you ever since I put the first pair of diapers on you. I said I was going to Atlanta with you, and going I is.
It's important to sort of talk about what we're not really officially talking about, which is that a lot of the parts around this time were basically what they played. And it wasn't as though Hattie McDaniel's winning this Oscar opened any doors for black women to do more than that.
Interesting.
They got more opportunities to do what she did.
Got it.
Basically.
Got it. So what's the next big landmark in black cinema after that?
Dorothy Dandridge becomes the first black woman nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress.
Right. She's not a maid, but she's still a sexy, you know, nightclub owner or worker.
Right. But I will say that there's something about watching this movie, which I've seen a number of times, and it's set on an army base, basically. And there is something really interesting about seeing black people, even in 1954, in a setting other than somebody's house or somebody,
that's
some
real
white person's car.
Yeah.
Hey, Carmen, how about going to passes with me tonight? I can dance those other guys throughout the floor.
T-Bone, you're too little and too late.
I don't waste no time. Dig me, baby?
Wasting your time right now, Sergeant. The wind's blowing in another direction. Ain't no use arguing with the wind.
Hey, how about going out with me tonight instead of playing the field?
Yeah, Carmen, pick out one. That'll release the rest of them.
It's an Otto Preminger movie. He's a white person. He never quite figured out how to do anything right with black people as an artist. The problems in this movie aren't necessarily because of Otto Preminger. They more come from the source material. But anyway.
But it is an opportunity to see, you know, black dynamics beyond the frame of whiteness necessarily.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so fast forward, and what's the next landmark for black women on the screen?
I mean, I would say it's probably Diane Carroll being Julia on TV.
Oh, right. Right.
And I mean, the reason that's a big deal, basically what we're trying to figure out are the number of times black women got a part on a TV show or in a movie that didn't require them to be some white person's best friend, sidekick, maid,
caretaker,
right? Exactly.
Shepherd,
driver,
spiritual guide, driver, cleaner upper, whatever. So that was 1968.
Yeah.
1973, our girl Pam Grier is Coffee and Coffee.
Right, and she also, like Julia, like Diane Carroll on Julia, is a nurse. But she's a nurse on a mission to avenge.
On a revenge mission.
Yeah, her dead little sister, and get the drug dealers back who caused her to OD. And that is during the blaxploitation era where black women had a little bit more to do, and they definitely weren't playing maids, but there were a lot of all the black men that we worship in these movies, you meet their mothers at some point. And part of the thing that they're trying to fight against is getting their mothers out of working in white people's houses. But there is an awareness in blaxploitation of this whole movie history.
Yeah.
I'm going to get the people who have this relationship wrong, but I think it's true of Superfly.
Okay.
I think Superfly's mother was a domestic. It's a number of men who are the children of black women who work in white people's houses.
Interesting.
And one of the things they want to do, either with their drug empire or, you know, their assassin outfit, is to get their mothers in stable.
Yeah.
Places so they don't have to work for white people anymore.
But isn't that a little bit different? I mean, not to get too derailed, but isn't that a little bit different because that was a reality of black families at that time.
Oh, yeah, women of course.
You know,
of course.
The women in the families were often domestics. And so that's a way of trying to recast something that's circumstantial versus being only seen as white producers and white directors and white screenwriters as domestics.
Yes.
There's a slight inverse thing that's happening there.
I mean, it's really smart of you to point that out because I think a lot of those movies, a lot of those blaxploitation movies were written and directed by white people. So
the plot thickens.
Not all
Get
of them,
out!
But a lot.
All right. So then we've got The Color Purple in 1985, which opens based on Alice Walker's novel. 11 Oscar noms. Wins none. Oscar's still so white, even 27 years ago. Okay.
And they snub Steven Spielberg because, you know, what does he know about black people. I don't know what they were thinking. Does the color purple mean anything to you in this context, though? I mean, Sophia, the character that Oprah Winfrey plays, mm-hmm. her, you know, she is a person who works in white people's homes.
I think as a child, the movie kind of embarrassed me, and I don't know why. It felt like something. I think there were so few movies about black womanhood that I ever encountered that having that be the only representation made me feel a little bit of a way. Like, these are the only types of stories I get told. And as a kid, I felt uncomfortable with it, with the sexuality of it, the sexual trauma, the sexual horror of the story, and just the violence that runs throughout. I think traumatized me. Also, my dad looked a lot like Danny Glover, so that kind of creeped me out. Wow. So there was just a lot going on there. Like, I just would be like, oh God, you know. But I recently rewatched it, and, you know, it's an incredible movie. I mean, I loved the books growing up, and I love the letters between the two sisters. Shug Avery is a, you know, a lesbian icon. Give Shug Avery your own TV show. I'm here for it. So my relationship as an adult, I mean, it's such a rich movie, and everyone in it is so good. And the play is incredible. So I have a different relationship to the franchise now than I did as a kid, which was basically non-existent. Okay, so then 1 year later, Oprah is asked to host Saturday Night Live. I didn't know about it, but you told me some real suspect things happened during that episode. Let the people know what went down.
Well, you can't find it on the internet now. It's been scrubbed. So basically, in this cold open, Lorne Michaels knocks on Oprah's dressing room door. And he wants to know why she hasn't changed into her Aunt Jemima costume yet.
I'm sorry, what?
Yes, Lorne says to Oprah, why aren't you Aunt Jemima? And she looks at him like he's crazy, and she said, you know, but she goes from like Oprah to, they push her into an angry black woman trap. And she says, like I said, I don't do Aunt Jemima, and furthermore, I'm not doing the maid sketch, I'm not doing the Brer Rabbit sketch, and you can just forget about me in the refrigerator repair sketch.
Oh my God.
Then she slams the door. And then Denitra Vance, the lone black female cast member in Tulsa Shears Amata, comes out dressed costume like Whoopi Goldberg in the color purple. And she's holding a silver tray with a matching coffee pot and a little porcelain cup for Lorne. And she picks the cup up and she calls him Mr. Lorne, by the way. And he says, Denitra, you're black. Then asks her, how, you know, what do I do about how bad and disobedient Oprah's being? And Denitra says what Oprah says in The Color Purple. Beat her.
No! Wesley. No.
I'm not making this up.
This is why Jordan Peele made Get Out. I mean, what the heck? That is appalling. That's appalling. Yeah. But this is helpful. This actually is setting us up for where we're trying to go. Okay, this is good to know. So, fast forward, 1992. The Bodyguard comes out, the first movie since Diana Ross and Mahogany, to give a black woman a splashy movie star, glamorous part. It made a ton of money, and it was a huge deal because Whitney's lover in the movie, spoiler alert, he was a white man named Kevin Costner. Okay, what's next?
A lot of stuff was happening on TV. Girlfriends happens in the 2000s. Then in 98, Living Single happens in the 90s.
World, lots of things, okay.
But Jada Pinkett stars in a movie called Woo.
Yes.
From 1998.
Yes.
She plays, I don't know how to describe Woo. She's
like a
indescribable,
sexy
which
woman
is part of the appeal.
In charge,
she's
large
got
in charge.
Standards about who she wants to sleep with.
That's right.
And doesn't want to just go out with any old tired man. She's glamorous. She might have a job. And part of the reason that I'm pushing this glamour thing as a priority is that everybody else, I mean, white women are glamorous all the time in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
They can be glamorous.
Mm-hmm.
They can not be glamorous. It's called a career.
Right. It's called range.
Right.
It's called got range.
I just feel like it's not as though there aren't non-glamorous black women, but we're talking about the fantasy of the movies.
Right.
And
right.
the toxic fantasies of the movies. And when black women exist only at one end of that fantasy.
That's right.
Or only have one fantasy projected onto them, it's a problem.
Yeah.
So I think a movie like Woo, which isn't even great, but I think that it is one of very few movies to try to do this with a black woman.
It makes it a milestone.
Yeah, can we play like just the opening sequence, which you're gonna die when you see, Jenna?
Celestial, I came as soon as I could.
Oh, girl, you look over.
These are for you, doll.
Oh, thank you, sugar. Mwah, mwah. Come sit down.
Okay.
A new motif. Girl, have I got news for you.
So what's the 411?
Girl, you will never believe what I've seen. Put your hand on the bone. Your house is in Scorpio. Gorgeous. Your moon is rising perfectly. Then, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's a meteor crossing your asteroid belt.
Is it good?
It's all good. Tonight is your special night, child.
Special in what way?
Let's consult the tarot daddy, shall we?
Okay, a couple years later, 2002. Halle Berry becomes the first Black woman in history to win an Oscar for Best Actress for her role in Monsters Ball, which of course is the movie with her and Billy Bob Thornton, and he plays a prison guard on death row who basically walks her husband to the chair,
yes,
to his death.
Bye, and Puffy.
Bye, R.E.P. Sean Diddy Combs. But, you know, the movie is successful, but it's also, it's very controversial because there are a lot of really raw and explicit sex scenes with her and Billy Bob Thornton, and people didn't know really how to feel about the portrayal of their relationship. But she wins the award, and she gives this gut-wrenching speech that we should listen to.
This moment, so much bigger than me. This moment is for Dorothy Dandridge, Lena Horne, Diane Carroll. It's for the women that stand beside me, Jada Pinkett, Angela Bassett, Vivica Fox, and it's for every nameless, faceless woman of color that now has a chance because this door tonight has been opened.
I mean, I'm emotional.
Yeah. It's real.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, did that Oscar, which she won more than 10 years ago at this point, really open doors to other Black women?
I would say for a long time the answer was no. But I think in Hollywood, everything works in like dog years or reverse dog years. I don't know how you count the dog years, but it's a long time, right? Like the rate of progress, it just takes longer for things to happen. And I'm not letting anybody off the hook. It should have happened the following year. Halle Berry should have been starring in everything, but was starring in nothing.
Right.
The parts after she wins the Oscar are A Bond Girl and Die Another Day.
Right.
Horror movie that she stars in with Robert Downey Jr. and Penelope Cruz called Gothica. She plays Storm again in an X-Men movie. Then Catwoman comes,
right,
which is supposed to be a triumph. And it kind of does
like
predict.
I did like that Catwoman, though. I did like that Catwoman, but I understand. I'll let
you talk me into that some other time. But I do think that was a huge deal because that woman poured all of her movie star capital, or a lot of it, into doing what everybody else will wind up doing 10 years later, which is being only in superhero in comic book movies.
Yeah, she's very ahead of the curve.
The movie didn't make any money.
Of course.
It was deemed a bomb, although it wasn't that much of a bomb, but because I just think people had their knives out for her in a weird way. They kind of wanted her to fail. Her career was never the same after she won that Oscar. To answer, continue with this question about like what happened after she won, I won't say nothing happened. I just think it took a long time for something to happen. And I think what we're talking about now in some ways is like a lot of the strands of that, of a moment like that and a couple others coming to fruition.
So just to bring us up to date, after that, we've got the Shonda Rhimes era, which starts in about 2005 with Grey's Anatomy. Mm-hmm. We've got OWN, Oprah's actual network, with Queen Sugar and Greenleaf starting about 10 years later, actually. Then we get Girls Trip. Tiffany Haddish emerges as a new comedy icon, hosts SNL, the fourth Black woman ever to host the show. And that brings us basically into where we are now with Proud Mary.
So, I mean, you can see in our very sort of cheap, not at all comprehensive overview of Black women in popular culture, or like certain landmarks for Black women in popular culture, that, I mean, things change and they don't change. It takes a long time. We're like simultaneously much farther along than we ever previously had been. But if you think about 1939 to now, and we're still wrestling with this history, like Jordan Peele is still giving us a Georgina to challenge this complacency right, that right. we might be feeling about how far we've come.
And then, of course, if Octavia Spencer gets nominated for her role in The Shape of Water, it'll be what you told me, the third time she's been nominated for playing a maid. I mean, it's like the distance between right. then and now is actually not that far.
Yeah, it'll be at least the third time she's been nominated for playing a black woman serving white people in the 60s.
Lord of mercy.
Yeah. But I think that we're pushing, there's a real change away from that now. And I think that it'll be interesting to see what this conversation looks like in 2 years. Guillermo del Toro is not a black woman. He's a Mexican man, but he's definitely aware of the way black women have functioned in all the American movies he's watched since he was a tiny
yeah,
baby.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I find whatever is happening now to be important. We're at a real turning point.
We should take a break and come back, but I think we have to ask ourselves why these figures have so much cultural currency, and if that's just what we're stuck with, or are there any alternatives? Are there any other alternative timelines we can imagine where black women aren't just playing these same prescripted roles?
Well, they can be keeping racist pedophiles out of the Senate.
Right, in Alabama.
And they could potentially be running the country right. as president of the United States. Let's talk about that.
All that and more when we come back.
What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories. Each of us in this room are celebrated because of the stories that we tell. And this year, we became the story. But it's not just a story affecting the entertainment industry. It's one that transcends any culture, geography, race, religion, politics, or workplace. So I want tonight to express gratitude to all the women who have endured years of abuse and assault because they, like my mother, had children to feed and bills to pay and dreams to pursue.
So I don't know what else there is to say. I mean, should we keep talking? Because she said it all.
That, of course, was Oprah Winfrey giving her speech at the Golden Globes for accepting the Cecil B. DeMille Award, the first black woman in history to receive it.
And one of the few women to get it. And this speech instigated a national panic. People were like losing their minds and doing cartwheels and going crazy. And
look, I get it. What we're talking about, of course, is the frenzy over the idea that Oprah could be our next president. If someone like Trump can get elected, why can't someone like Oprah? And the logic goes on from there, which is that logic is terrible to begin with. But I think we can explain this away really easily, which is that there were some black people honestly talking about Oprah being president. That's real. But I just want to say that it's a larger black colloquialism online to be like, Simone Biles for president, which I tweeted during the Olympics. Now, I don't think she should run for president. I don't want her to run for president. That's a terrible job. But it's just something we say that I think people are so, I think also this thing is happening on social media where people are so eager to prove they're woke, to prove they're mm-hmm. on the right side of history, mm-hmm. to prove they're mm-hmm. one of the good guys, that we're all doing this thing that my friend Mona calls virtue signaling. So it's like, how can I prove to you I get it, I get it, I get it, I get it. We saw this with Oprah. We also saw it after the Roy Moore, you know, debacle in Alabama when everyone was like, black women will save us. Yes, just put black women in charge of the country. But then you said something to me that was really brilliant, which was,
black women historically and based in popular culture have been the cleaners.
Right.
They've been the caretakers. They've been the people responsible for making things better that they didn't mess up in the first place.
Right.
And being president is kind of a thankless job. It's hard to say Oprah shouldn't be president in that, I mean, I'm with you. I'm like, Oprah should be like fake president.
She should just be the queen.
She should be a figurative president.
Right.
She should be the royalty she is. She's done so much. As Oprah Winfrey.
She's still doing so much. She's doing it for herself.
What is the presidency?
She's the president of OWN. She is the president. She's the president of Oprah.com. She's the CEO of Oprah Incorporated. It's like, that's the part that kind of drives me crazy. And I think what we're trying to prove in the course of this conversation is that when calling for Oprah to be president, without really understanding the political implications, what her political desires are, even if she has any, is you're directly invoking this antebellum archetype of mm-hmm. women, mm-hmm. black women, mm-hmm. who are seen as the caretakers and the shepherds of American society. And that is the only role that they're able to have. Whether or not you are aware of it, that's what you're doing.
First of all, let's just unpack what we're talking about when we talk about Oprah, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I also think that what you're saying, not only in terms of virtue signaling, but also in terms of what happens to the culture when a black person manages to speak to all of it. And throughout the history of American culture, there are more than a handful of people who've succeeded in doing this, right? There's a line in Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee's movie, that John Turturro has to Spike Lee's character Mookie, where he, you know, is explaining, you know, that he, okay, maybe he's racist. He accepts that. But he also likes some black people, but the people he likes aren't really black. They're, quote, more than black, unquote. And so there's a thing that happens when a black person reaches a certain level of fame.
There's a sense that they've transcended.
Right.
Something.
Right. And it's safe to get on board right. with that right. transcendence.
That's right.
Oprah is such a person. Oprah is a person who, you know, through her own sheer belief in humanity, through her own struggles with all of her traumas,
right.
has become somebody that lots of different people can quite justifiably see themselves in. And I can remember when the show was on, we didn't talk about the show as being a landmark for black women, but it obviously was. It started in 1986, September of 1986, lasted for 3 decades.
Right.
And I remember a lot of the conversations that people in my family were having about Oprah had everything to do with the discomfort that we had been brainwashed into feeling about a big black woman. A big black woman in an audience of white people?
Of course.
Do we trust that? Do we distrust it? What do we do? Like, we're simultaneously proud and uncomfortable.
Right. I mean, when Oprah's show went national, there was suddenly a new archetype, more or less. There was a new type of black female iconography on a major stage. And because her audience was either equally as white as it was black, or maybe predominantly white, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of ambivalence, and even I would say suspicion, about mm-hmm. what kinds of images are being consumed and why. But a lot of those arguments were during the peak of her show, and when she really started to branch out, like in the late 2000s, I would say. Like, I mean, I was reading an essay last night from 2007 by Tarshia L. Stanley called The Specter of Oprah Winfrey. And it's kind of raising this question about the peripheral suspicion, this is what Tarshia says, that Oprah invokes among black women, that maybe she's fodder for a white cultural imagination that is eager to swell the physical and visual bodies of black women without being conscious of it. So I read that and I was like, yeah, I think that when Oprah was just on TV, because TV is such a powerful medium, it's also a medium with not a lot of context and it's very produced and very managed. I think that was a really valid thing to raise in 2007. But 2007 is not 2017. Mm. Oprah is really present on social media. She gives so much insight into her life, mm-hmm. her relationships, her blackness. I think she's much more forthcoming about like who she's making content for. I mm-hmm. mean, obviously OWN is convenient because it stands for Oprah Winfrey Network, but it also, OWN is a word that means my own, our own, like mm-hmm. our, you know, mm-hmm. it's essentially a way mm-hmm. of saying FUBU, I feel. And I think you can look at the programming that she's putting out. I think Queen Sugar and Greenleaf are really key examples. All the work she's doing with Ava DuVernay. I think any suspicions that I had, I didn't really have suspicions about Oprah back in the day, really, but any suspicions that might have been invoked by her presence in 2007, for me, feel really set aside right now in terms of how she's representing herself. She just feels so wholly in control of who she is, that who's consuming her or who's consuming her images doesn't matter. Oprah's just doing Oprah.
Right. But doesn't that then lead us to this problem of Oprah for president and the sort of mental, the sickness that we have as a culture to want to go through some version, like a liberal version of what we're currently going through?
But can a mammy be a mammy if she's a billionaire? I think there's a double consciousness at play with Oprah.
Of course, of course.
And
of
black
course.
Women in particular are so adept at understanding how they're being viewed. Look at Serena Williams. Look at any major. Nicki Minaj, yeah. Lupita Nyong'o, like any black woman in the public eye is at all times completely aware of how they're being looked at. I think she actively uses her social media to counter that. I think she was criticized for erasing her blackness in the 2000s and beyond.
Yes.
Which with also maybe kind of not recognizing that that was maybe part of something she had to do in order to get ahead. And I think that there is a deliberate way in which she's always trying to reconnect to herself and let us know. I mean, you know, Instagramming herself on the dressing room before the Golden Globes, getting her hair pieces put. I mean, you know, that's deeply intimate, and that's deliberate. Right. That's very deliberate.
I also think that her choices as an actress have been really interesting, too. Playing Setha in Beloved.
Right.
In 98, I think fighting to get the Women of Brewster Place film.
Oh my God,
Gloria Naylor's novel was that was a major TV event in my house. And when it happened, and I remember just being so riveted by the chance to see Oprah Winfrey off the talk show doing something. It's hard to really, it's really important, I mean, at least for me to remember how often I watched that show as like a little black man, you know, every day just about to like get the Oprah Winfrey show in my bloodstream. The idea of seeing her outside the context of that show was always interesting.
Also in The Butler, her amazing boozy.
Right. She was really great in
The Butler.
Just
in all that power red and the hair and eating the pie off the gorgeous china. That's me. I mean,
she's great.
Listen.
But I think you kind of have to begin to wrap your head around what it means to have a black woman conglomerate, right? A black woman who runs her own show, has a production company, is donating lots of money, opening schools, working on her own ideas of self-performance, having the most famous fiancé that's never culminated in an actual marriage. That's definitely in American history. She has been bringing so many of us with her for so long that it makes a kind of sense if you believe in whatever it is we've been educated to believe the presidency is. And it does make a kind of sense for you if you believe that the most important job an American can have and can want to do is run the country.
Right, right. But in sort of trying to revise and reconstruct what America can be, right? And like trying to reimagine the history via the future of America, it's like there's a deep unawareness at how that just totally reinforces and reconstructs this old ass history that already exists.
Yep.
That's the thing.
Yep.
I mean, I think there's something to be said too for all the movies and TV shows we talked about earlier that are coming out right now, talking about Insecure, talking about Grown-ish, about what we're trying to understand is how much do these shows have agency and whether or not they can reconstruct their own images independently of these stereotypes. And that's what we're grappling with. Like, it's very difficult when you're still operating under a white gaze in entertainment, especially of trying to figure out like how are these looks and how are these presentations going to be digested? It's just really hard. It's just really hard to undo that long arc of everything that came before, more or less.
Can I ask you a question? How do you feel as a black woman about all this stuff? Do you recognize yourself in any of these depictions of black womanhood?
Ooh, I mean, I want to see myself in the reflective pool that is Oprah, because I too want to be a billionaire who builds schools and has a best friend like relationship that's like, you know, famous for just being super tight and intimate. No, I mean, it is a funny thing watching different trend lines emerge. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting watching black female visibility become marketability, right? Mm. Name a systemic crisis, police violence, wage, you know, parity. I mean, it's just, it's laughable, right? And so I think there's a disconnect in our white American imagination about what's good for an individual being good for a group. Mm. And there's a big gap between those two things.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to looking at all the new shows that are on television that are trying to get at different parts of what it means to be a black woman today, and also, I mean, I want to see more shows poke at the definition of a woman. Like, I'm really here for more things on the gender spectrum, too, that deal with blackness, like more intersectionality in that sense. But shows like Grown-ish excite me. Shows like She's Gotta Have It, which I kind of came in thinking I was absolutely going to dislike. And there were moments of that where I just had to laugh, you know, and in a good way, where it's just like, this is a show about a woman who's really trying to find herself and it's not perfect. Really, the only thing that show proves to me is that just put a woman in charge of that show. Like, there's no reason that there should be a bunch of people who are not in the age demographic of this character writing about this character. But it does feel a little bit exciting to, even if people are getting it wrong, just to feel like we even have the option to try.
To fail. I mean, to
failure
not
get it
right.
Failure is a luxury in this way. Right. Yeah, right. Failure. And that's, you know, I'm not where Issa Rae is at when she says I'm voting for everyone black, because I think we need to be critical about the black art and work that's being made.
It's just because it's black doesn't mean it's good.
But I want there to be really bad black TV and art and film and everything to be out there. And I want to have the choice.
Absolutely. I mean, if I can say, that's what's great about this Taraji Henson movie.
Of course.
Is that it is terrible. And thank God, because it doesn't have to be great. She can be just as bad as like people way less interesting than she is, and there's so much more pressure on this bad thing to work. And I don't know, I'm with you. Like, there has to be a range of, you have to be able to fail and try and
not be punished for your failures.
Right. And not be punished for your failures. I mean, some things aren't gonna work, and you have to be able to know what those things are to either not do them again or fix them when they don't do well. I don't know, and I feel like Oprah is somebody actually who's had a lot of failure too. And she's learned from, I don't know. I haven't heard her talk a lot about this, but I have to think that as being the person she is, she's learned from the things that haven't worked.
And she keeps going.
And she keeps going.
In that sense, yeah, I do see myself in that. And it does feel like freedom, and it does feel like the future. It just, and I mean, thank God for Oprah, because she also knows she's reaching a hand backward and forward as much as she has stretching those gorgeous arms outward to everyone else too. You know, it's like she's so deeply aware of where she is in this continuum that gives me a lot of hope. That's our show.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Still Processing is a product of the New York Times.
It's produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman,
Josh Gwynn,
Ann Hepperman,
Henry Malofsky,
Jessica Jupiter,
and Max Linsky from Pineapple Street Media.
Our gracious editor is Sasha Weiss. We have editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
And our theme music is by Kindness. It's called World Restart from his album Otherness.
As always, you can find all of our episodes and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. And hey, if you feel like it, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. See you next week.
Bye, everybody.